giving and accepting awards. This is even quicker. Awards mean not only awards, but also votes of thanks. If you're thanking life members or devotees or whatever for their participation in something or for going out and distributing a lot of books or helping with something, that's also in the nature of an award. The main thing I want to point your attention to, again, are two. First one is, be brief. The second, same as previous advice. The second point is, don't overpraise. Today we'd like to thank one of the most sincere and wonderful devotees in this temple. He worked selflessly, sometimes throughout the day and night, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. All sorts of things that aren't true. Don't say it. Say true things. Say them briefly. Say them sincerely. And leave it at that. Otherwise, your audience knows they're not true. And you've got them thinking, instead of appreciating the person, they're thinking about how all these things you're saying aren't true. And that doesn't create the kind of congenial atmosphere you want. It has the opposite effect. Any questions about that? Or anything else on the sheet? Yes?
One thing about getting people's attention.
Yes.
Sometimes it becomes very difficult. You know? Do you have any tips for this?
Yes, sometimes. First of all, consider where you are. Sometimes you're in a situation where it's impossible, or where you have to wait 5 minutes. You know, where people will have their attention, but not now. Like if they're all looking, scattered, they're all scurrying to sit down and take prasadam. You won't get their attention. But when they sit down, you may get their attention. So consider the appropriate time. Speak loud. That gets attention. Your little mousy voice doesn't get anyone's attention. And the third thing is, sometimes just look at people and wave. That sometimes gets attention. Rather than trying to talk over a big... Just look at everybody. Let them know that you're ready to say something, and that you're not going to say it until they pipe down. Those are different methods. Any other questions? Yes.
If you wanted to do it or not, but I said necessary to mention what can be announced and what cannot be announced in the temple.
Everything absolutely necessary can be announced in the temple. Everything else shouldn't be.
Necessary.
If it really requires an announcement, if everybody in the temple, or nearly everybody, needs to hear it, announce it. If they don't announce it. If it's going to substantially benefit or organize something for the sake of all the devotees in the temple, then it may be worth an announcement. If there's any other way to accomplish it, such as posting a notice on the bulletin board, announcing it at some alternative time, like prasadam.
I was thinking of the general attitude of what can be spoken within the temple room.
What can be spoken? Avoided.
Every year, when the festival is all this big marketplace, the temple room taking, you know, don't buy this shop, buy this shop, don't buy service here, buy this there.
Well, if that's considered absolutely necessary, then it's necessary. Otherwise, it's not necessary. Yeah, I would discourage the use of the temple as a place for making ads. Devotees don't appreciate it. They prefer to chant their rounds. And they're right. They should chant their rounds. They need to chant their rounds, especially during festivals. Bulletin boards, posters, alternative means of communication are strongly recommended. Not that everything has to be an announcement in the temple. Any more than everything has to be a telephone call between one city or another. Other forms are to be preferred. When everybody really needs to hear it, make it a morning announcement. Sometimes it should be a morning announcement. If the guy out front is acting against the interests of the temple by occupying one of our stores, and we really want to make sure he's blockaded, then maybe that's the best way to do it, by a morning announcement. Plus signs. Don't overestimate the power of morning announcements. Signs are sometimes a heck of a lot more effective, especially if you have a lot of signs. Anything else? Okay. Yes?
About the second part of the sheet.
Yes.
Accept the reward in the same way in which it is presented.
Yes, someone, yes. Means if someone very seriously presents you an award with a very sincere attitude and with great formality, then don't accept it by saying, well, I always expected I'd get an award like this, and now the time's finally come. So it's really, don't respond with attempted humor. On the other hand, if he awards you something very humorously, then don't accept it with great formality. Respond appropriately. As the award is given, accept it in the same mood. That's the idea. Okay? Yes? Anything else? Good. Our chief fighters are out of station today. Begumon and Indudumna Maharaj. No problem. I've got 87 debatable topics. They're all debatable.
That's debatable.
Well, such as sense control makes you agitated?
Yes.
There is no absolute truth?
Sense control makes you
agitated. There's nothing wrong with eating meat? Or there's no soul. Reincarnation isn't true. Any preferences? There's no soul. Good, solid, mainline argument. There is no soul. You're not going to convince me there's a soul. I don't see it, I don't smell it, I don't touch it. Okay, there is a soul and there isn't a soul. Those are the two sides.
Now, I'm up for the non-existence of the soul.
Huh.
But Sujit, who was arguing against him, should have stuck more to his points. He had good points, but he didn't stick with them. He let take him away.
Radha Manohar is good. I saw it. He's feisty. He's assertive. He decides what he's going to talk about, and then he makes the argument go that way.
That was a nice bully.
Hmm?
It wasn't
exactly a bully. Yeah, he's a bully. And Sudeep is a gentleman. So sometimes the gentlemen have to be a little more bullyish. Just like Chanakya Pandit says that when dealing with the crooked, you have to be crooked. So dealing with the bullies, you may have to be a little bit of a bully yourself. Some other reports? Yes?
I learned something from watching the argument that because the devotee had previously used one argument that didn't work against one thing, it was as pertaining to comparing a live body with a dead body, doesn't necessarily mean that it wouldn't necessarily work against another argument that someone brought. So one argument may be very effective on one circumstance, but under another circumstance, the same argument.
You mean an argument might support one conclusion, but not support another conclusion?
Right.
Right. So you have to know what your argument works for, or under what circumstances it works. The argument that something is stated in Bhagavad Gita is an absolutely effective argument for someone who accepts Bhagavad Gita. It's not an effective argument for a person who hasn't agreed to accept Bhagavad Gita. Similarly, an appeal to science might be an excellent argument for a person who accepts the authority of science. But for others like us, it doesn't fly. Similarly, that there's a difference between a living body and a dead body might support one argument, but it might not support another argument. It might support that if you're arguing that there's consciousness in the body, then this difference between a living body and dead body might support that. If you're arguing that there's an individual soul in everybody and that it's not all one, that argument really doesn't do anything in that regard. Okay? Other reports? Yes?
I saw the problem with the person argument. I guess if you work on either side, our arguer here stuck with this topic. Mm-hmm. And he kept trying to get the other person to get back to saying, well, how does that prove there's a soul? And the other person was trying to make so many other points, and I felt weak with his...
You're saying sticking to his point made him strong.
Yes.
That's our general experience. That if you're jumping all over the place, trying this, trying that, trying this, trying that, then you may just be allowing your opponent to carry you all over the place. Whereas if you stick to your point, Srila Prabhupada would often do that. My point is, thou shalt not kill. My point is, there's a difference between the living body and the dead body. By sticking to his point, particularly when it's a point for which the opposition had no answer, he kept his position very strong. So you saw that happen in action. Another report. Ashavanapur.
I saw that you have to be very tough if you don't want the person to change topics.
That's right.
And I gave some example. And then he had something to dispute about the example, just about the, sometimes you bring up, I said, look at this building. And he wanted to say something else about the building, but in a completely other context.
Irrelevant objection. Suppose this building is 40 years old. That means, wait a second, it looks to me like this building's only 20 years old. Irrelevant objection. It has nothing to do with what you're talking about.
And it's very tempting to go in and say, of course it's only 40 years old, it's 40 years old, and just waste so much time.
That's right. Radhama?
Yeah, fine. You have to be, if you don't want to be maneuvered around, you have to be in control. You cannot let the other party put you in the defensive position, like you're the guilty one, you're the one that is arguing that around. You have to always stick to the point, even by if you have to use body language, that you're right. Ananda was going on and trying to question me about my own opinion of what the universe and the soul is and the whole thing. Like, I saw that the situation was getting pretty edgy there. But then you had to, like, no matter how, like, trying to move him out of there because the situation is getting, like...
These are good realizations. As they say, the best defense is a good offense. So when you have an attached argument, that is, when you really want to push your point, then push it. Don't be cowardly. Don't be afraid to try to push your point as strongly as possible. Radha Manohar wasn't afraid. He did very well just by saying, wait a second, and this and that, and this and that. Right? He was assertive. So don't be afraid to be assertive when you've got something important for you to assert. Don't be, what's the word, cowed. Another point. Very good. Indradumna Maharaj also did the same thing. Just whatever anybody said, he just found a way to push his points. Yes.
I saw too during this argument, if we are going to use statements of people that they consider authorities, we have to be very familiar with them. Otherwise, if we misquote the name, we misquote the circumstance, if the name is recognized by them, it can completely turn against us.
Yes, good point. Know your authorities. If you appeal to be to authorities, know your authorities. Is your authority out of date? Is your authority discredited? Does your authority have some weird angle of vision on something? Maybe he is a good botanist, but maybe he's also a member of the Flat Earth Society. That could be embarrassing for you. Maybe he's been caught fudging the results of something. Or maybe you really don't know what he said, and you're just using his name unclearly. Maybe he's against your position. Since you quoted such and such, perhaps you should know that he's one of the staunchest atheists. And he says about your position, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, lead yourself into trouble. Best policy is stick by your own authorities. And use the other authorities sparingly and cautiously. Other points? Good point. Yes?
One should also be convinced to his examples, or because sometimes people say some example but don't end it with strong conclusion, and then it becomes, you know, very weak.
What's the best way to do that?
I can give just an example. One person was saying, in Srimad Bhagavatam there is my spiritual master wrote a very logical proof for existence of the soul. This leg is mine, this head is mine, this hand is mine, hand is mine. So this body is mine, so it means I'm the owner, and this I is the soul. But then the other person said that, I agree that this hand, leg, and soul is mine. That's what I am. I'm this body.
Interesting. And then what happened?
Went
through a different topic. What do you do at that time? When somebody answers, yeah, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine, that shows that I'm this body.
That doesn't mix. This is my book, I'm not this book. My pen, I'm not this pen.
If yes?
If you analyze it linguistically, you can say, you don't say, I am, I foot, I am head.
Yeah. Just say, wait a second. Don't let him switch the stuff. Say, wait a second. And then make the point Janaka made, or the point that Minavatar made. What you're saying doesn't make sense. If this is mine, and this is mine, and this is mine, that means there must be an I, who's the owner.
Did you say my soul? Sorry, but this is just a limitation of our language. English.
But you should
but
be able to.
Other languages may think of the.
I'm not talking language. There's the hand which is controlled by you, and there's the you who's the controller of the hand. And that's not words I put into your mouth. That's your own words.
Without the body, consciousness is nothing.
Excuse me.
Without the body, the consciousness is nothing.
That's a separate question. And it's not at all demonstrated. My point is that analyzing that you have a hand and that you are the controller of the hand, that means there's a difference between you and the hand. Otherwise your statement becomes meaningless. I have a hand and I control it. That means there's two distinct entities, myself and my hand. That's all we're trying to show.
But does that mean that he's casting proof that it is a soul?
Excuse me?
Separate things.
What? That we can discuss later. My point is that there's two distinct things. There's my hand and myself. Similarly, there's my leg and myself. There's my head and myself. And you follow that argument to its conclusion.
You can say, I am my soul. So I'm not the soul. It's my soul.
Yeah, that one we'd approach linguistically and say that that's a fault of the language. My soul. And who is that I? That doesn't make any sense.
No, I have a body and I have a soul. It's a combination of chemicals.
What if you're a combination of chemicals?
The soul is in it.
How do you get a soul?
Ask him.
Oh, ask him that. No, I'm asking you. You're saying that you're chemicals. You are chemicals. Essentially, what you're saying is that chemicals produce consciousness.
Yes.
So I want evidence of that. I'm willing to accept it. Just give me evidence and I'll accept it. Can you produce chemicals, consciousness with chemicals? Has anyone produced it? And why should we? Has it been scientifically demonstrated? Can you explain the process by which chemicals produce consciousness? Can you answer yes to any of those questions? Then why should we accept such a theory? Why should you even accept such a theory?
Because there's no other theory.
Rather, do we see that consciousness creates chemicals? Yes. Does a tree create citric acid? Yes. Tree is a living entity and it creates chemicals. So matter create consciousness creates matter, but we don't see matter creating consciousness. Some other points that came up? You have to listen carefully to what people say. How did I get Radha Manohar? Just by listening to him. He actually said that there's a difference between myself and my hands. And all I had to do was listen to him say it, and then I'd realize that he'd said it. And I'd take his argument from a different point of view. Well, listen carefully to what people say. Yes?
One problem with this format is that the combatants don't admit that they've been beaten many times.
That's not a problem with this format. That's a problem with arguments in general.
I'm just saying that in the actual preaching field, people who would be willing to sit with you long enough to hack it out with you, they'd be able to eliminate their fallacies more honestly.
Do you all agree with that?
No, I mean, there's so many. You selected on who you spend time with. You selected on who you speak with.
Let's argue about this.
I find people more reasonable that I preach to than the devotees who take
when,
part
when
of
you
the
say the fact that most people don't, like John Kapoor was saying, most people don't spend enough time actually giving these things much thought, then when you do bring it to their attention, the way that they're looking at things, and you clear it up for them, actually, when they do spend the time enough with you to think about it, it doesn't make sense.
It really depends. If you're select, there's two ways that you can view this. If you're selective about your audience, if you pick more or less submissive targets, then yes, they'll agree with you fairly quickly, or at least they won't present unreasonable resistance. On the other hand, if you deal extensively with people who are not submissive, you'll find that they'll go on and on and on and on from here to eternity and not accept your point under any circumstances. Do you think the people that Sataputta has to deal with, for example, give in after 10 or 15 minutes? No way. They come up with newer and newer arguments. It's not always so easy. And sometimes, by being willing to deal with people who do have arguments and arguments and arguments and arguments, and being up to them, ready to do battle with them, you finally come out on top. Sometimes the person's just unreasonable, and after a while you say, all right, here's a lot of... But sometimes, you can actually, just by wearing a person out, by letting him try A and try B and try C and try D and try E, and finally run out of arguments, he'll surrender. My experience is that people will go on and on arguing. Some of them. Some will, some won't. Other points. I wanted to make a couple myself. One is I heard the word proof here mentioned a few minutes ago. Proof of the soul. That our spiritual master proves in Srimad Bhagavatam. That's a very word I'd use with great care. Proof of something. What constitutes proof? Evidence. You say that he gives evidence or gives a logical argument. The proof is a very heavy thing. Very rigid to prove something. To prove the existence of the soul. I don't even know if it's possible. You can indicate it, give evidence of it. If you accept Shastra, then there's proof. We accept Shastra's authority. Shastra says there's a soul. Therefore, there's a soul. QED. It's proven. Otherwise, if a person wants it proven, if someone wants it proven on empiric grounds, actually there's no proof. Empiric proof is unavailable. Empiric evidence, even overwhelming empiric evidence, is available. But proof is a very strong thing. Another point. I heard in the course of some argument, someone presented something as a supposed fact. Think that your hair continues to grow after you die or something. And one of our devotees, having learned in the class how to deal with such a thing, says, well, I don't accept that. Show me evidence that that's true. What authority says so? So he obeyed the principle, doubt everything. So I was a little proud of him. But I'd add one more thing. I'd say, well, I don't know that that's true. And even if it is true, it doesn't say anything about my argument. My argument stands anyway. Because, first of all, that you haven't heard of it doesn't mean that everyone else may not have heard of it. There may be 10 other people in your audience who have heard of it and who believe it, whether it's demonstrated or not. Or, in fact, it may be in every science textbook in the world, complete with science, you know, with... It may be a standard fact and you're just ignorant. So give yourself a double protection. Well, I don't know that that's true. I'm not convinced of it. I haven't seen it demonstrated in a lab. My textbooks that I read is not there. And so what? It's irrelevant. Even if hair grows after the body's dead, the mushrooms grow from dead bodies too. It doesn't mean that the body's alive or this or that. You know, give them a double whammy. I'm not sure that your evidence is correct, and even if it is correct, it doesn't say anything about my point. It doesn't defeat my point. My point is, and then go on the attack again.
Yeah. Well, my hesitancy to go on with that, I wanted to squelch it the way I did, because that I had already made the premise that, you know, the soul is the active principle. So if he showed me that there's activity after the soul's gone, that's a pretty strong point for his side.
No, it's not. There's decomposition after the body dies, too.
It's also activity.
It's also activity. Does it mean that I'm still present after the death of my body? No.
Or after you leave your apartment, there's still bugs.
Yeah. Fight them. I'm not sure that your facts are facts, number one. And even if they are facts, so what? Yes.
If you unplug the fan, it's still moving. So it doesn't mean there was no electricity.
That's right. Come up with 101 arguments. It's a residual effect. Because the power was there, it still grows. How long will it grow? Will it grow for a year? Something is missing. Okay? So challenge facts, disbelieve things, but watch out that you don't appear to be just a weak fellow or an ignorant fellow who escapes from a perfectly reasonable argument by saying, well, you know, I know, I haven't seen that the sky's blue. Okay.
So,
yes?
There's also some family example, like, so why don't you put this bucket before the television set and let me watch the television and, you know...
Put what? Yeah?
It's if it's still acting and alive, then set putting before the television set.
Give him a hard time. All right, if the person is still there, let's see what he can do. Go on the attack. Radha Manohar's point. One other point I heard, Sudip was being attacked with the idea that there's no soul, there's a reservoir of consciousness. There's a reservoir of consciousness. There's just one big consciousness. It's like a big hunk of stuff. Just like you've got earth, you've got water, you've got fire, you've got different elements, or you've got plutonium, you've got nitrogen, you've got hydrogen. So there's stuff called consciousness. And when this stuff enters the body, then the thing goes. But there's no soul, no particular individual soul, right? Was that the argument?
Yes.
More or less? I didn't hear a good answer for it. What's a good answer? Yeah.
This consciousness that you have, who does it belong to?
Wherever it's found, but you know, this plutonium, this iodine that you find in the body, who does it belong to? If it's in my body, it belongs to me.
Okay, then who are you?
I'm this little hunk of consciousness. I'm this little hunk of consciousness that's split off from the big reservoir. And when death takes place, then I merge back into the big reservoir.
But you said that the consciousness belongs to you.
That's a conventional way of speaking. Just like this iodine belongs to me. It doesn't belong to me. For some time, the iodine comes together with the nitrogen and the hydrogen and the consciousness and all this other stuff, and I say, this is me. Then death takes place and it's all finished.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? That was his point.
Call it what you like, consciousness or lack of consciousness or the reservoir of consciousness, but the name doesn't change. That you may call it death.
Okay, that I'll accept that there's a big reservoir of consciousness, and from that big reservoir of consciousness, it comes out and there's no, you know, perpetual existence of a soul or anything like that. It's just like this stuff, consciousness, which coexists with matter. And, it, you know, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not there. That's all. Okay, I accept that.
And please explain the nature of this consciousness.
You are an individual, and the proof is that if you think, well, let me move and go to the store, then not everybody's going to go to the store.
I accept that I'm an individual. That's just because, you know, the way things are constituted. Just like there's a big mass of iodine, so, you know, a little trace of it's in me. And because of that, that iodine is part of my unique personality. Wait a second, let me finish. There's this much iodine, there's this much hydrogen, the whole business comes together for some time, and it forms an individual unit. Just like in this clock, there's a big reservoir of plastic, you know, there's plastic everywhere, but in this clock there's a certain amount of plastic shaped a certain way, which makes up this individual clock. And after some time, the clock will be smashed, plastic will be distributed, and that's the end of it. So the same thing about my consciousness. For some time it's here, and then, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. That's it. Yes?
If there is a dead body, by putting back all those iodine and plutonium...
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that you can reconstitute it. I'm just saying somehow or other it comes for some time, stays, and this individual unit manifests its activities, and then the thing falls apart. And that's it. I'm not saying that you can put it back together again.
Your clock.
Any more than if this clock gets smashed, you can put it back together. It runs out, finished. Or a battery. When a battery is dead, it's dead.
So where did all this mass amount of iodines and consciousness come from?
Where's the question of come from? They exist. I can't say anything about where they came from.
Well,
they exist.
This is a question that we are
That's not the question you're asking. You're asking whether or not there's a soul. And I'm saying, no, there's no soul, there's just this consciousness.
No, we're not asking you. We're telling you that there's a soul.
Referring to the fact that it comes within you, that this consciousness itself.
That's just a whatchamacallit argument. That's a linguistic argument. I have a good argument. The real thing is, this is the standard Mayavadi argument. Everything is one. So my question is, if there's just consciousness, what splits up this consciousness into individual units? What is the mechanism by which consciousness gets split into individual units?
Yeah, what is it?
There's no such mechanism. We present that consciousness is individual. You're individual now, in your childhood you're an individual, in the future you're individual. Consciousness is individual by its nature. Why should we assume that there's just a big reservoir of consciousness and that the souls get split up into little itsy-bitsy pieces?
What would be the reason?
Hmm?
What would be the reason?
And what would do it?
Yeah.
What agency would do that?
That's that intentionality.
But doesn't it say that we are like the Jiva Tattva, like we are renamed from the main Tattva?
Yeah, I mean, you can also take it that way. Alright, we're all parts of the reservoir of consciousness. But I'm an individual, then what is the nature of that reservoir of consciousness? I'm a little spark of consciousness, and if I analyze myself, I'm an individual. Therefore, if you analyze the reservoir, it will also be individual. Just like the drop of water in the ocean of water. Drop is H2O, the ocean will be. Take that argument. There are many different ways by which you can win an argument. Many different arguments that you can give. Many different reasons to support your conclusion. So, like Radha Manohar, be aggressive and support your conclusion strongly. Hare Krishna.